You ever get the feeling that everything in America is completely f***ed up?
They're saying I should think stuff. Something is wrong with me.
Practice. Welcome to what is, as of now, being rebranded as Politicalamity here on Positive Cynicism. We'll get more into that in the coming weeks, but I am joined, as always, as usual, on the political episodes by the political expert here on the Positive Cynicism podcast by Brandon Cooley. Brandon, welcome back to the show. It's been a month, and you know, not much has happened in the last month in politics.
Oh, yeah, not much. Yeah, no. Just a few things.
Yeah, hopefully we can come up with some topics to talk about for the next hour or so. Let's start off with the main thing. You know, it seems to be what we talk about every month, because there seems to be one every month, and that is not a mass shooting. Those are later. But the Democratic debate. We had one. We were recording this on Sunday, the September 15th. There was a debate on September 12th, and this one was limited to 10 people, or 10 candidates, I should say. Did you watch the debate?
I did, yes. Interesting fact that had it been 11 people, it'd be two debates, or two nights, which I would have preferred.
Yeah.
Five people on the stage, or six people instead of 10, but I did watch it, yeah. Yeah, it was, I'm glad they're down to 10 people, but again, it was still 10 people on the stage, so I don't know what the difference is in that case. It's still only a minute for someone to answer a question. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
Yeah. I watched the first like 45 minutes of the debate. I went to, because there were only 10, as we've said, which means there are like 11 people that did not get to be on the debate stage. And one of them was Marianne Williamson, who has come out of the first two debates, with a lot of, I don't want to say notoriety, but you know, she's one that, gets a lot of press after the debates for things that she says. She did not qualify for this debate, and so she ended up doing, they aired the debate live out here in California, and then she was speaking afterwards to give, I guess, her rebuttal. And so I went to watch that just to see what it was like, and after 45 minutes of watching the debate, I'm like, no, I can't stay here for another 2 hours, and then, you know, however long she was going to talk top of that. And you know, this is something that we'll get into later when we discuss other candidates that weren't on the stage. I am really surprised that people like Klobuchar, Castro, and even Booker to an extent are on the stage. Like, again, I think it goes back to the name brand recognition that these people are polling, because personally, as I've said here on the show before, I would have rather seen Marianne Williamson up there. I would have rather seen Tulsi Gabbard up there. And you know, there's a lot of, lack of a better term, controversy surrounding the Tulsi Gabbard exclusion, because this debate was set up by, you had to be polling at 2% in Democratic-approved polls, which no one was sure which polls they were going on. But we'll get more into that. But first, I want to get your reactions to the debate. What did you think? You said, you know, it's better that there were only 10, although it's still 10 people on stage. Who do you think came out looking good, who came out, you know, not looking so good, and who lost their teeth?
Well, any primary debate that has more than seven or eight candidates, there's going to be problems. It's just, it's kind of like a computer doing seven or eight things at once. It's going to be slow. You know, it's just not going to work. So at this point, we're still just waiting for the field to kind of go down to six or seven candidates. And what, because the problem we're finding is that nothing's really changing after each debate. It's really just all based on name recognition. Like, they say that the only reason why Biden and Sanders are still in the top three candidates is because it's just name recognition, basically. People are still finding out who these people are. So until we're down to like six candidates, we're just going to keep on doing the same thing, and the top five will be the same people, which would be Biden, Warren, Sanders, Harris, and Buttigieg. I mean, Cory Booker, someone like him can maybe break into the top five, possibly, but it's been this way for a while now. I don't think anybody really benefited from this last debate. Biden did better at first. I thought that his first couple answers were pretty good. Then by the end, he was kind of seeming old like he did last time. So Sanders at this point is like a broken record player, just repeating the same thing over and over again. Warren has been making some ground, taking away some of Sanders supporters. Not sure how far that will go, but yeah, nothing's really changed since the last debate, really.
And I was reading something this past week that said, you know, talking about the polling and how well the candidates do, and they mentioned that Sanders in 2016 didn't really start polling well until after the New Hampshire primary, where he did well, helped probably because he was a senator from Vermont, so he's known in the New Hampshire area as well. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm curious to see once we start actually going, you know, once the primaries kick in, where the politicians will start to, you know, even out, because like you said, this is all name recognition. It's there's not a lot being covered. Let me rephrase it. There's a lot being covered, but not critically, I think, by the media. It's all just repeating what the candidates are saying. And like you said, it's been 3 months now, and what has changed in those 3 months, other than I think Biden has slipped a little and Warren is taking over a little bit more. But other than that, nothing has changed in the after the three debates that we've had.
Yeah, and something to mention, too, is that the last couple of primaries for both parties, it was apparent by March or April that Trump would be the nominee for 2016 and Romney would be the nominee for 2012. On the other hand, with the primaries between Clinton and Sanders and Obama and Clinton, we didn't really find out who the nominee would be until summer, roughly, mm-hmm. like May or June. I can't remember exactly the month in 2008 because I was too young, but it was pretty close. Now, I would argue Clinton obviously was going to win because Sanders just wasn't getting enough votes. Mm-hmm. He did win some primaries that were surprising. Or he tied Clinton in Iowa. So what's going to happen, I think, is it's going to go for quite a long time. We won't know the nominees until the summer. And it's going to be because there's a split between the moderates and the progressives. Or as they say, there is. I believe there's more moderates in the Democratic Party than, like, far-left people. But other people would disagree with me. But there's going to be a split between Biden or Warren or Biden Sanders going for quite a while, or whoever replaces Biden if he goes down at some point.
Yeah. Well, let's get into what was said. Like I said, I did not watch the full debate. I've seen highlights, read recaps. My first thought in watching the debate, starting off, and I know I'm not going to be able to explain this in a way that probably doesn't sound racist, but when Jorge Ramirez, I believe that's his last name, from Univision, started talking, he was one of the panelists on the debate for ABC. He was from Univision. When he started speaking in Spanish, again, to me, that's just like, it feels like the Democrats are trying to pander so hard to the Hispanic community that I think that's going to turn off a lot of moderate voters. And it's also, you know, it raises his flag of illegal immigrants. And again, I'm stressing illegal immigrants or undocumented, if that's your preferred nomenclature, cannot vote. So appealing to that sector just seems like a kind of like a shooting yourself in the foot sort of way to go. Let's start there. What are your thoughts on the, because, you know, in the first debate, you had Booker and Beto speaking Spanish. What do you think about the Democrats trying to appeal to that base?
Well, I'll start off by saying that, like, there's a difference between pandering and the actual policy. Mm-hmm. And that's, you can see that easily in these debates because some of it is pandering because basically the people watching this debate and really getting engaged in it are already really liberal anyway. Mm-hmm. So they're trying to appeal to those people. And they do that by pandering sometimes and not actually talking about world policy. Some candidates do, but sometimes is pandering. And that's maybe an example when that's the case with the actual issue with illegal immigration. There should be a path to citizenship, I think, mm-hmm. and they should be talking about that and what would be the policy behind that and what to do with people who come here legally. I would argue that on the Republican side, they're not going to discuss it at all or how to solve it because those immigrants will become voters and mm-hmm. Democrat. They don't want them to be citizens. And then I think that's not to be, it's kind of blatant, but that is the reason why there's no solution on the right to how mm-hmm. to solve illegal immigration, but the Democrats lean a solution too. It doesn't mean that they're right just by because they don't have a solution. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not, there still needs to be a policy. You can still pander, have a policy at the same time, and there needs to be a bit of both in order to win over voters. I mean, that's
No, I agree with you, and I think if it was reversed to where those Hispanic persons would, if they would be voting more in block with the Republican Party, you would see a flip-flop. You would see the Republicans trying to get to it and the Democrats trying to block it. And I do think the Republicans definitely do need to do a better job of reaching out to the minority vote. And we can get into it a little bit later. It's, I mean, you know, there's a whole, I'll often hear liberal friends say, you know, complain about like people in the South voting Republican and voting against their interest. But at the same time, you can flip that around with, you know, you look at your cities like Baltimore, Chicago, Detroit, Flint, all these places that are have been liberally ran for 50 or more years, and nothing has changed. So, I mean, that is a whole bigger discussion of why people vote the way they do for people that don't seem to actually get anything accomplished. Back to this debate, I think when they were going through and introducing themselves or doing their opening speech, because the debate was set, you know, they were in Houston, when Amy Klobuchar made the joke, Houston, we have a problem, blah, 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 someone should have just ran up, picked her up, and taken her off stage and be like, you're disqualified. no, you know, stop with the... And I actually saw a video where she has a joke that she's been saying almost at every stop about making fun of Donald Trump's hair and how her hair is real. I don't know if you've seen this clip, but I don't know why someone in her party has not told her to stop telling that joke, because one, it's not funny. Two, she's not a comedian, so she doesn't have the delivery and the timing. And three, it's just, it's not a good joke. So
it's disappointing, because she actually, her opening speech and her first speech in the snow that some months ago, she has some jokes that actually landed pretty well. And apparently that hasn't, she got too confident in her jokes and it hasn't paid off. But it's usually jokes don't land too well with politicians. Yeah. Every once in a while they do. There's a few, I think, that chuckled at. But usually we're laughing at the politicians in debates, not laughing with them. That's typically that's the way it goes. But
Like I said, if one Saturday Night Live comes back, it'll be interesting to see how they poke fun at the candidates.
Yeah. They got to get the casting right, though.
they did just hire their first Asian cast member, so they have an Andrew Yang. So, that's good. And speaking of Andrew Yang, you know, there's a lot of debate about, or I guess criticism of Trump being a game show host and a reality TV president. And then you have Andrew Yang come out and say, go to my website, I'm giving away $1,000 to 10 families for the next year.
Yeah.
And my one big question is, okay, if you're going to do this now while you're running, why haven't you done this previously? Because I believe his businesses have the money to do so. Again, I am all for voluntary giving of money and charity, and all that is good. But when you're running on a platform of giving out other people's money and only then decide to give away some of your, it just seems very, again, pandering and... it just seems like something to do to get a news bite about your campaign.
Well, just the idea of giving people money, just giving out money to people without any kind of incentive or tax break is just ridiculous to begin with. But the idea of doing it while you're a candidate, I'm not even sure if it's really legal, technically, to just give out money for support.
Yeah.
But maybe it's different than that. But yeah, that was one of the moments I kind of chuckled at. just I can't believe that his people around him wouldn't say, you know, maybe we shouldn't go that far. It's no, I do like Andrew Yang's policy on, like, just the basic, he'd be a great labor secretary, so to speak, just because of his automation, you know, all the stuff he's been talking about with that. It's good he's bringing that to the table, kind of like how Jay Inslee brought discussions of climate change to the table. But, I mean, these aren't serious candidates anyway, so, I mean, I don't know why they're still on the debate stage. But at the same time, if the DNC chose who was going to be on the debate stage, or just had a debate between three of them, or two of them, that would be seen as being unfair. Even though I'd rather see a debate between Biden and Warren, we're not going to get that until it's just the two of them on the debate stage. So
Real quick, this is because we've discussed it here on the show before, and I've seen a lot of people complaining because there are so many people running, you know, there's at least 21, 22 candidates that are running. If you go to Baskin-Robbins, they promote 31 flavors of ice cream and give you 31 choices. But in our politics, we seem to want very few choices. And granted, as we've said, the debate setup is flawed because you can't have that many people on stage. And if they spread it out over like a week of debates, people are only going to tune into the ones that they've already kind of predetermined to like. They're not going to listen to each and every one of them. But I'll throw it out to you, since you're the liberal voice on this show and we're in the Democratic primary. Do you think we should have a cap at how many candidates can run, what do you think is the best way to ensure that we actually get a solid candidate running?
Well, it's complicated because it can't be a cap because technically anybody can run. It'd be first come, first serve if there was a cap. I don't know how that would work, but basically the DNC tried to do that last time with Clinton over Sanders. The people in the DNC preferred Clinton. Now, they didn't control the votes, but they preferred Clinton, and that was seen as being corrupt. So I don't see how you'd ever, behind the scenes, try to limit the candidates. Mm-hmm. The best they can do is using poll numbers and donations. That's kind of worked, but we still have, 20 candidates, so I don't know. I mean, like they said, this next debate is going to actually have Tom Steyer in it because he technically passed the threshold. And maybe Tulsi Gabbard, she might pass the threshold next. They almost made it this time. But the best they can do is just keep increasing the number of the thresholds for polling and donations. I don't see how there's a good way of actually, because anybody, if you're favoriting anybody, you're going to be end up getting backlash from the people who now support other candidates. So.
All right. Well, then I'm going to jump to a topic that is going to bring up later. After the debate, or actually while the debate was going on, I was texting with some friends and one of them responded and said, and told me that Ben Glebe was running for president. And he even said, he's like, I don't know how serious he is. And I only knew Ben Glebe as the host of the game show Idiot Test on Game Show Network. And so I started looking up, and I'm like, and I'd seen him last year at Politicon. He moderated one of the panels. And I was curious as to why he was there. Not curious enough to actually go back and look it up and try to see what his background was. But apparently Ben Glebe is actually running for president. And it seems to be very serious. And I sent you a few clips or told you to, you know, look him up to see your thoughts, because we're going to discuss it. But one issue that I think I really I like about his campaign is his attitude of, look, the media is not going to cover me, so I have to go and make myself known, because the media already knows who they're going to cover. And I don't know if you saw the footage, but there's Amy Klobuchar, who's probably getting a lot more airtime on this podcast than she did on the actual debate. But she was doing a media hit in Iowa. And when she was done, Ben Glebe kind of walks up and says, hi, I'm Ben Glebe. I'm running for president, too. But since you won't come to me, I'm going to come to you. And kind of took over her thing when she was done. So I guess my thought on this whole thing is, what role does the media have in accurately portraying everyone who is running? Because, you know, there used to be the fair use or the fair time doctrine, whatever it's called, where you had to give equal time to candidates. That seems to have gone away for the most part. But do you think that the media should cover more candidates or just focus on the top names?
Well, the media, they're portrayed as picking winners and losers. And I wouldn't say that. I would say they chase shiny objects, whatever's in the news, which means on social media sometimes. But so it's not about them really picking the top candidates and following them. It's just basically they want to get the most viewers. They want to get the most clicks. So they're going to choose those candidates because they have the most followers. Now, with Ben Glebe, he could, get noticed by the media if he said something controversial or something that would cause him to be a shiny object, essentially. A comedian running is kind of interesting. I watched his video. He seems cool. I don't know. It'd be fun to hang out with him. But in terms of, I don't know his policy. I have to look into that. His video didn't really go into that too much. It was mostly just about the fact he's running as a comedian, which, to his credit, authentic. But, John Stewart running would be preferable because he has name recognition.
Right.
I didn't know who Bing Lieb was until I looked him up. But so, yeah, I mean, we can see if he gets anywhere. But it's kind of too late by this point because of donations in the debates. But, yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate we didn't have anybody running this time that's like, that is a comedian or has something like that where there's the name recognition, but also like an authentic, because comedians are more authentic than, I mean, there is a comparison I made once to a friend that politicians don't, they can't be scripted. They need material in the same way comedians have material. As in, the comedian doesn't have a script they go off of. They just go up there on stage and they just tell the joke of what they remember. It's because they wrote down material beforehand. It's kind of the same deal with politicians when they're doing a speech. So it kind of lends itself to that.
Well, and that's why
he can say Trump's a comedian, but a bad comedian. He just kind of goes up there and complains, which they think is funny. So
that's what I was going to say. Trump is the one who breaks that rule because he just gets up there and he may have something prepared, which when he sticks to the prepared statements, he sounds good. When he goes off, it's very hit or miss. Although I did like, and I don't know if this was scripted, but his joke this during the debate, he was giving a speech and said he was not in favor of the new low energy light bulbs because they make him look orange, which I saw there was some newspaper, I think, that fact-checked that claim and said it was not the light bulbs that make him look orange. And so, again, good job, media, of hit it covering the major stories. But yeah, I am torn because I understand media only has a certain amount of time. They only have, you know, television shows only have so much time to fill. Newspapers only have so much space to print, but I just feel like, especially after the 2016 election, where you know, I will say the Democrats rigged it for Hillary. That's why we didn't have any serious contenders to her. But now it just seems like there's not enough coverage of idea. Like we said, we're so early into this. Like, we shouldn't even be covering candidates right now. It should be like the Oscar season where you only get like 2 months to campaign. But I am just curious to see when how things are going to come. And I think that the media does obviously have their favorites and they're going to cover them. But staying with Ben Glebe real quick, I think this also highlights the problem that we have in America where, you know, we say anybody can be president, but that's not 100% true because you have to have name recognition. You have to have money. You have to have the connections. Like, if you or I decided to run for president, we're not going to get very far because no one's going to give us the attention because, you know, we could have the best plans out there, but.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, I mean, we can't be CEO of a company either, or a company that we could start our own business, but we couldn't be CEO of a large company because we don't have the experience of being in that company or the experience of running another large company. So, I mean, anything like that is going to require some degree of experience or SaaS or expertise or knowledge. So, yeah. The other thing, too, about the Ben Glebe running, the idea of a comedian running, is there's actually kind of a contradiction with the Democrats, because any good comedian is going to be politically incorrect to some extent to get laughs, or at least I think any good comedian is going to. That's the way I define as a good comedian. And right now with the Democrats around, I don't know the exact number, but a portion of them, it's this social media like driven like political correctness where they would reject Ben Glebe if he said something that was publicly incorrect to make a point about something. For example, I mean, Dave Chappelle's one of my favorite stand-ups. Okay. He released a Sticks and Stones thing on Netflix. Mm-hmm. And my brother and I watched it. I was really funny. We laughed about most of it. Turns out people hated it online. They thought it was the most
let's clarify. Critics hated it online.
Yeah.
Audiences loved it.
Hated it. Yeah. 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 Well, yeah, audiences loved it. And then, but there was a portion of the really far left on Twitter that didn't like it, and critics didn't like it because they're kind of part of that group too. Yeah, I don't know these numbers because Twitter's hard to analyze that way. Yeah. But the point being, though, is that he got a lot of pushback. And so anybody who runs, who says something controversial, even when they're making a point, is going to get pushback. Mm. So it's kind of a problem right now when and that way with conservatives, there's some of that too. But.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting topic to see where, because comedians should be, and I think have always been, the one place where you can say things that are not socially acceptable. because you're doing it to make, as long as you're doing it to, you know, highlight a point or show hypocrisy. I remember Daniel Tosh in his first comedy special DVD, he had a comment where he's like, just in case you're listening and you get triggered easily, I'm going to say this joke unedited, so you may want to skip ahead about a minute. But he said, you know, so what do you think about these all these faggots getting married? It's okay, I can say that. I'm black. Now, try to figure out why the second part of that joke makes the first part okay. And for the record, if you don't know, Daniel Tosh is not black. But then he's like, yeah, now, you know, you laugh, but go try to tell him that joke at work tomorrow. And you'll promptly be fired. And it's that same thing where if he did that joke today, there would be so much outrage and backlash against him. And we live in this cancel culture, which we're going to be covering on another episode here on Positive Cynicism in a few weeks. But it's, like you said, it's, and I think going back into the political realm, I'll use Tulsi Gabbard as the example, because she isn't towing the Democratic line with a lot of her views. And I think that's why she's not getting as much attention or as much, or why she's getting some blowback, is because she's, you know, not speaking the way they feel that she should.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There's a purity test with the Democrats for sure on the left, sort of the moderates, but no, it's different. But yeah, there's a purity test where they have to meet the criteria of like 10 different issues or more in order to pass it, yeah, or to be a good candidate. And some people don't, on the left, don't even vote at all. I mean, that's why I think that Clinton lost, because enough millennials didn't vote for compared to Obama. But yeah, I mean, with the whole like Tosh thing, I mean, yeah, with comedians, I mean, they are essentially allowed to do that because they are comedians. So some of us do watch movies or TV to listen to taboo subject matter because it's interesting or because it's funny, like comedians, you know. There's a line to cross, like, I think it was Kramer from, what's his name? Who
Michael
said,
Richards.
Michael Richards, who started, like, yelling out racial slurs, yeah, and that obviously crosses the line. Yeah. Now, will I still watch Seinfeld the show? Absolutely, but that doesn't. So it's just like the people need to know when to pick their battles on Twitter, and they'll never change. There's not going to be.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I made the comment on Twitter on Friday because there was, during the debate, I guess it was Sinclair Broadcasting Networks ran an ad. It was anti-AOC, and it was started out with a picture of her that then was lit on fire and burned, and then showed the horrors of the Cambodian genocide under Pol Pot. And it was talking about, you know, how bad socialism is. And then on Twitter on Friday, it became boycott ABC and boycott Sinclair for airing this ad. And it just seems like every day, you know, last week it was boycott. There was a Olive Garden. It seems like every week there's a new boycott movement because someone either said something you didn't like or supports something that you don't support. And it's social media, it's Twitter. So really need to remember that that's not speaking for the vast majority of people, but I just don't understand why we live in a society where if you don't like something, your first instinct is to, for lack of better terms, cancel it. Or why you can't just say, okay, I don't like this. Like I said, okay, Michael Richards, for example, if you said, okay, I don't like what he said, this affects the way that I view Seinfeld, I'm not going to watch that show. But you shouldn't be going, no one can watch Seinfeld, it needs to be taken off the air.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's that way with a lot of things. I mean, you don't have to like your Cosby Show. I'd still watch it, but I get why people wouldn't, because it's awkward. I get it, you know. But no one should be shamed into watching it. I don't know. But or like companies that you'd boycott. I mean, I think boycott's the wrong word. Like if I had to go somewhere for my arts and crafts, which I never had to do, but I'd go to Michael's instead of Hobby Lobby because I, you know, don't like the values Hobby Lobby has. You know, if I compare the two, or I just want to shop at Costco because Costco has. They pay the workers a good wage, so I would prefer shopping there than Walmart, which I worked for, and that wasn't. I mean, it doesn't have to be a boycott. It just has to be a preference, you know? I don't see why, like, it. But people make, you know, small things, not even small things, but just make a big deal about stuff on Twitter, and it gets to be a whole argument, so.
Yeah, I am, like you said, if you don't agree with something and you don't want to support them, that's cool. But telling other people that they can't seems to be over... stepping the line. And speaking of telling people what they can do, let's get back to the debate, because you know, for the last 3 years, we have heard how Trump is a fascist, how he's a dictator, how, you know, he's just controlling. What I heard and saw on the debate stage, not only this time, but in the previous ones, is we're going to take your guns. Hell yes, we're going to take your guns. We need to, and this is more, I think, from the climate control discussions that were on CNN a week ago. We're going to, you know, cut down on the amount of meat that you're allowed to eat. And everyone has to is going to have to start driving an electric car for the society, for not society, but for the climate. The Democrats seem to be very dictatorish in what they, you know, Kamala Harris says, either this happens by government, by Congress, or I'm going to issue executive order to do it on my first day. And then she also said that she's going to get rid of the filibuster, which I believe Joe Biden pointed out, you can't do that. That's not in your realm of power. But do you see the Democrats being very kind of dictatorish and telling people what they're going to be able to do and can't do?
Well, I wouldn't use dictatorship or fascism. I wouldn't use those words. But the ultimate irony is that with Bill Clinton, we had a centrist president. With Obama, we had a center-left president. Huh. And now, you know, the ones I like on there would be Buttigieg, Biden, Klobuchar in terms of policy. And they're not like that. But we have some that are just embracing socialism, basically. I mean, or not socialism, but stuff that pretty much comes close to that, close enough to being socialism. Like the whole healthcare thing, which I just shocked by, that they want to actually take away private health insurance. Not a public option. Mm-hmm. Like, that's why I support. They don't just take away private health insurance. That's, I think, is crazy. And the argument is that, well, people don't like it. It's like, well, no, some people don't. Some do. Like, that's not. Anyway, yeah. So there are some things that on the left that are like, the gun thing is a good example. I mean, it's regulation doesn't mean taking guns away. There's, you know, not either, you know, either or, but yeah. And on the right, there's some of that too, but yeah, it's getting to where they're just appealing to the far left of the party, not the party as a whole, which would be moderate Democrats, center left Democrats. So.
Yeah, I know. I just, well, and speaking of, calling him out by name now, Beto O'Rourke, because he's the one that said, yes, we're coming to take your AR-15s. And then conveniently his website had a t-shirt up after the debate with that saying, much like Kamala Harris had a t-shirt about the little girl, or the little girl was me or something after the first debate. And it's like, again, we go back, was this a planned statement, you know, that they have ready to go so that then they can launch and campaign off of or fundraise off of? Or is it something that just comes out in the debate? And then I saw over the weekend that Beto was on one of the, I think he was on the Joy Reid show, and he was asked if, you know, if he thought people would turn in their guns if they made them mandatory gun buyback. And he said something to the extent of, yes, I think all law-abiding citizens would do it because they realize it's the law and you have to abide by it. And it's like, well, if that's the case, then we don't really need to get rid of guns because murder is illegal. And if you're a law-abiding person, you're not going to shoot anyone. So I don't know. I don't know if you saw that Ted Cruz and Alyssa Milano had a sit-down meeting to discuss gun violence. Mm-hmm. And I think you can watch the video online. I think they actually live-streamed it. I've not watched it because, one, I don't really care that much to hear that discussion. I'd rather hear that discussion in Congress. But, you know, I think we have all these topics which, like we said, have been so far divided, that trying to come together and work for a common ground where one side is going to have to, actually both sides should realize they're not going to get everything that they want. And you have to learn to compromise. And I know we've mentioned it a couple episodes ago, but do you ever think that we will ever see that compromise in Congress again?
Not in the near future. I don't know. It takes something really bad for it to happen. I mean, like another a war. I mean, basically, countries come together when there's a war. That's always the case. I mean, that sounds really negative to say, but I mean, they came together with the Depression. But the thing is, with the recession 10 years ago, I mean, that made it even worse. So I don't know. I mean, I don't see it happening anytime soon unless something really bad happens. But Yeah, I mean, with the whole, like, I mean, you know, my beliefs with the gun legislation is the more deadly the weapon, the harder it should be to get with more regulations or whatever. But the word ban is much more appealing to people, you know, banning a weapon versus, you know, regulations against getting it or whatever. And there is no solution to the mass that the thing is, the crime rate's gone down, but the mass shootings have gone up. There's no solution to that because, I mean, it's just random. You don't, you know, you have to really track social media and who's, I mean, but even then you don't know the kind of person that, you know, snaps. So it's just not even. Yeah. But see, the thing is though, I mean, these debates are meant to make, whether it's a Democratic debate or Republican debate, it's meant to make the party feel good. It's meant to people who are really into politics on the left and right really go are involved to talk to people who agree with them already. They're not, they don't go to talk to people who they may disagree with on certain issues or have a good debate. They're not into it for that reason. They're just there to meet people who confirm what they already believe, basically.
Yeah. That's a good one. Yeah. And I mean, there was the point during the debate where, is it Julio Castro? Is that his first name? Julio.
Julian Castro.
Okay. He started, you know, yelling at Joe Biden, like, you know, you just said that 2 minutes ago. Don't you remember what he said? And then Buttigieg, like, you know, this is why people don't like the debates and blah, blah. Like, we need to come together. And Booker's like, no, this is what a debate is. And I think that's, like, the first debate really wasn't a debate because it was everybody just echoing the same opinion and basically just saying, hey, vote for me because I'm cooler than the other person. And now we're kind of getting to where we see the differences, but we're also like, they're trying to stand out. And especially when you have people like Castro, Klobuchar, Yang, who aren't as well known, have to try to get, you know, that one soundbite that's going to get played over and over, like, much like Tulsi Gabbard did after the second debate when she criticized Kamala Harris.
Yeah. And that moment with Castro and Biden, I mean, I had to chuckle because Biden wasn't even contradicting himself in that moment. It wasn't even make sense. And he was knocking his age, or it seemed that way. And so it was tempting for Biden to say, look at you on the edge of the stage there, kind of like how Trump did with Rand Paul, I think. That's tempting, but then would he have lost voters for saying that? I don't know. It's, I mean, the truth is that we do tune in. Some of us do tune in to see a food fight. I mean, that's tempting. We also want policy. Some of us do. But yeah, I mean, how, like, at what point does it become just like a Jerry Springer episode? I don't know. I mean, it became that way last time with the Republican debates, for sure. I mean, that... Yeah. That ended up getting a lot of viewers. I mean, the fact Trump was there. So, I mean, there's an argument to be made that they should be, you know, should be more entertaining. But then does it just become, you know, no substance, basically? That's the, yeah.
Yeah, and I think, you know, 2016, I think Trump helped get the viewers just because, again, no one thought Trump would win. You know, no one expected him to be president. But they wanted to see what type of clown show the debates would be with him in it, which is not a good thing. Like, you want, like you said, you want substance, but you need the fire. You want someone who is, I mean, I can say that from a conservative-leaning standpoint, that I think part of the reason Trump did win was because he was fighting back and he was attacking his critics, which is something Republicans don't normally do because, well, for various reasons. But I think that helped him kind of win over the crowd. But again, was it good? Is it good politics? No. Do I want to see that from the Democratic side? I mean, yes, from a train wreck perspective of just watching these, again, in this debate, 10 people that I will probably not vote for. Sure, let them knock each other out. But then I want to see the substance from people that I think actually have plans or have ideas that aren't so far left, that are more moderate, that can help, you know, bring the country back together.
Well, I mean, my theory for why Trump won essentially is because he was a simple candidate. He said simple things and stuff was good or bad, good or, you know, and there is no equivalent to Trump on the left, but the candidates who are getting attention are like that, you know, Sanders, you know, my policies are good, capitalism is bad, this, you know, that kind of thing. Not that he's that simple, but yeah, the more simple a candidate is in their rhetoric, the more the news will follow them because that's easier to report or easier to get to get commentary on, because now the cable news is commentary. It's not really news. But so that's why I think Trump won is, you know, you could say it's saying the media almost had to cover because people were talking about it. So it's he was just he's the one yelling, basically. He got the most attention.
Yeah. And when you're dealing with video media, you know, a 5-second soundbite plays a lot better than a 3-minute nuanced answer. So
yeah,
that's going to work out that way. So you mentioned Tom Steyer is going to probably be in the next debate. Other than seeing his campaign ads and his impeachment ads, I don't really know that much about him. What do you think he's going to bring to the table for the next debate?
As many things, impeachment, which they're still talking about in Congress, I think. It's no one should really care anymore about that, but probably nothing. I mean, like, for one, Democrats aren't going to vote for a billionaire candidate unless it's like Oprah. I mean, that's not going to happen. It's Tom Steyer is just some old white guy who's just, yeah, who has the commercials on TV. I mean, there's really nothing about him that's really going to be that, it's going to take away any supporters from Biden or anybody like that. I mean, Tulsi Gabbard could make the debate stage next, but I don't know. The people who would drop out this next time around would be people who didn't make the debate stages last time, which is unfortunate because I like John Delaney. I mean, he has no chance, but I like his performance last time. He kind of stood up to the idea of taking the health care away. But yeah, I mean, what do you think about I saw an op-ed in the Washington Post by the three candidates on the Republican side who are trying to run but can't because they're shutting down the primaries on the Republican side. It's Walsh and the guy we talked about last.
Bill Weld,
and then the third person. I don't know anything about. I know who Joe Walsh is and Bill Weld, but I don't know the third person. Yeah, so what do you think about?
I can't remember who the third person is right now. One, I don't think they'd have any chance. But I do think if they are running, they deserve the chance to be heard. And if that means there should be a Republican primary or debate so that they can lay out their cause against Trump. You know, I guess technically voted for Bill Weld in the last election because I voted for Gary Johnson, which, again, libertarians were like, hey, you know, the Republicans and Democrats are like, look, we have two horrible candidates. And libertarians are like, hold our beer. We're going to put up another one. But yeah, I think they should be heard. I don't think they have any chance. Even what little I know about them, if they weren't going up against Trump, I wouldn't give them a, you know, if they were going up against the other named Republicans that ran in 2016, I wouldn't give them a chance. So I think it's more of a distraction ploy and more of trying to divide the Republican vote or the moderate vote to try to help the Democrats get in.
Yeah, I mean, presidents who lost re-election had serious primary, or not serious primary challengers, but they had primary challengers who had name recognition. So I'm waiting for Kasich or Romney to run against Trump. Mm-hmm. The three of them don't really have enough name recognition to really make a dent, but yeah, I want there to be a primary because I kind of want to see that debate on TV, but whether or not they have a chance, no, of course not. But the cynic in me wants them to run just to, throw a wrench to it all. But,
no, and I think it, again, they should. And I said, this is the hard part for me because I'm not a pro Trump. I was thinking about it the other day, my Democratic candidate of choice right now, as I've said on the show, is Tulsi Gabbard. And if she actually won and it was her versus Trump, it would be a hard debate for me to figure out which one I wanted to vote for. And I would have to hear all their plans. But I think a debate for Trump to go up against the Republican candidates would help. Well, if he was a normal politician, it would help him kind of lay out everything that he has done that has been good for the country. Unfortunately, because it's Trump, it would probably be like 10% that and 90% just making fun of the other candidates or Sleepy Joe and Pocahontas and not even addressing actual issues.
Well, if it was this time next year, maybe not even this time, but next summer, if there's a recession or the summer, next summer, what would you want the response to be from either side or Trump, from Trump or the policy positions on the left?
You know,
of what to do about the recession. What would be your, like, because that's going to be a problem because no one has any solution.
That's the thing. I'm not a economic genius, so I don't know what this, what I would like to hear is a solid plan. And unfortunately, even if you give me a solid plan, it's probably going to play more into what do I feel is the better plan as opposed to what are the facts of a good plan that will actually work. Because if you say, oh, we need to raise taxes to do this, I'm automatically going to be like, I don't support that idea because I don't support raising taxes. But if it's, so I don't know, you know, again, it'll have to be, I just want a plan. I don't want to hear hyperbole. I don't want to hear hypothetical situations, but I want a solid plan.
Well, I'll say this. I'm concerned what Trump would do because I don't like George W. Bush, but I'll say this, though. What they did in 2008, not that it would be as bad as 2008, but what they did with what him, Paulson, and Geithner did with the reset, with the collapse, so to speak. I agree with them what they did, basically, and they had to take one for the team. I mean, they did stuff that Republicans disagreed with, what some Democrats disagreed with, but they did what they had to do to prevent a depression. With Trump, either he's going to get reelected or not, I mean, he's going to have to face this problem eventually, or he'll just, like, it could be 2021 that happens, but yeah, I see a lot of problems when there's a economic downturn, because he essentially has surrounded himself with the yes men, who just, he wants people who agree with him, he wants to be, you know, praised for just nothing. So, I mean, I see a lot of problems when there's actually, like, a serious economic crisis going to happen.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, I would agree that he is the George Lucas of politicians who have just surrounded himself and said, yes, Jar Jar Binks is a great idea, President. You should go with that.
For example, the tax cuts. I mean, theoretically, there can be tax cuts, but we didn't need the tax cuts when they were passed anyway. The economy was taking off already, so we have no money to do another tax cut. We have no money to really do anything like a jobs program, infrastructure. I mean, for the economy being good, supposedly the deficit's been just skyrocketing.
And again, and that is out of my wheelhouse to know the cause and effect. I can only look at my, and this may not be the best way to do it. I can only look at my paycheck and say, well, I'm making more money. I'm doing well. Although living in California doesn't really help that much. But I see, I'm going to take this in a different direction, but that's where I go with, like, when the Democrats were talking about getting off of fossil fuel, like, I support innovation and moving to clean energy. However, I don't think you can just do that in, you know, a set amount of time and say, okay, in 5 years and 10 years, we're all going to be off fossil fuels. Everybody's going to be driving an electric car. And it's going to be great because then there are so many other variables in that process. Like, what do you do with the coal miners? What do you do with the oil drillers? You know, people that run gas stations, people that work at gas stations, people that, you know, for me, I can't have an electric car because I don't have I can't put a charging station in my apartment complex. And the fact that, I mean, electric cars just don't seem viable for long distance driving. I could be wrong because I don't have one. I don't know. But like, there are so many other variables where the soundbite of we'll be off fossil fuel in 10 years sounds great, but no one's explaining how to get that practically.
Well, the funny thing is that the Green New Deal is named after the New Deal. And what they don't understand is the New Deal wasn't a 20 page, like, I've actually read the New Deal. Yeah. And that's not what the New Deal was. It was like 20 pieces of legislation or so passed over like 8 years, and the benefits weren't seen for another 20. I mean, it was all good things that paid off in the end, but it cost a lot of money, some of it didn't work, actually. A lot of it did, some of it didn't, and it was controversial at the time. The Green New Deal is no, it's not even comparable. And their argument, like, I mean, I get what they're saying, that, like, we went to the moon, you know, and JFK said we could, and we did, you know, 9 years later, but that's not the same thing. It's not the same. It'd be great if everybody treated it that way. They treated the green energy as if it were the next, you know, trip to the moon. But there needs to be incentives. There needs to be, like, an affordable plan. There needs to be, like, and for one, the Green New Deal is actually everything. It's actually healthcare. It's a whole bunch of stuff on, like, it's almost like a utopian kind of bill, which I'm against because it's just not feasible. I support the idea of a Green New Deal, but what it is, I can't really support because it's not feasible. So
yeah, and I think I would agree with that. Like, I don't agree. I don't agree with the, you know, we only have 12 years to live, or else we're all going to die. Climate hysteria, and it'll be interesting in 12 years if we're still here. How the Republicans spin that for the next election.
We'll still be here, but a lot of people living in third world countries will be suffering. I mean, that's always going to be
well,
the case.
They're always suffering, but
yeah. Well, yeah.
But yeah, but I think if we can actually sit down and talk and have the discussion reasonably without playing politics, there is room there to agree and to work towards the future. Unfortunately, our political system is broken, and we're only listening to the extreme fringes that will not get along. So I wish there's a solid answer. I wish there was an easy answer. And but I just don't see it, unfortunately.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you summed up pretty well.
Yeah.
I would like to have a candidate that would just be the, you know, the shining. There, it'd be nice to have the next Abraham Lincoln. But the thing is, though, Abraham Lincoln was extremely controversial at his time. So all the presidents we supposedly admire were pretty controversial. So, I mean, it's not like any candidate's going to bring people together.
Yeah,
I know.
For me, that was when I was in Dallas a few years ago and going to the book depository and seeing the history of JFK. And I never realized that the reason he was in Dallas was he was trying to pull the party back together. Like, there were a lot of people that didn't like him on the Democratic side. All I've heard is JFK was great. JFK is awesome, but.
Well, you know the reason why people on Democrats didn't like him, right? It was Northern Democrats liked him, Southern Democrats didn't, because he was wanting to do something about civil rights. Mm. The irony, he was assassinated, then LBJ did things about civil rights, and that tore apart the party. And they didn't really tear apart the party, but it kind of realigned it. But yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah.
Interesting. Anyway, all right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this episode. When we come back next month, there will, I believe, be another debate held in October. I don't know the exact date, but I'm sure we'll be talking about it. It'll be interesting to see what happens there. So for the next month, I guess, before we get to that point, do you have any last things, any last comments or words of advice you want to give to the candidates?
I don't have any predictions anymore. I can't. I mean, for one, nothing's changing in the debate, so it's just pointless to even predict anything. But yeah, I'm just waiting until Iowa.
Yeah,
the Iowa caucus and New Hampshire primary at this point, just to see who would get come out on top. I don't know. It's not going to change until then. So.
All right. Sounds good. Well, that's going to do it. Tune in next time for another episode of Positive Cynicism. And as always, question everything. Do something positive.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.